The Tudor History and Travel Show is a podcast that brings Tudor history to life by exploring Tudor places and artifacts in the flesh. You will be travelling through time with Sarah Morris, the Tudor Travel Guide, uncovering the stories behind some of the most amazing Tudor locations and objects in the UK. Because when you visit a Tudor building, it is only time and not space which separates you from the past. And now over to your host, Sarah Morris.
Hello, my friends. It's Sarah, the Tudor Travel Guide here, delighted to be back with you and to guide you through our next Tudor adventure together. Well, we only have one bit of housekeeping to attend to before we can get straight on with the meat of today's podcast. If you are a lover of historical fiction, then this is for you, my friends, because in case you missed it, on the anniversary of Anne Boleyn's execution, the 19th of May, I formally launched the audiobook of Volume 2 of Le Temps Viendra, a novel of Anne Boleyn. Yes, this was my baby, my first book, which I began writing in 2010 and published in 2012 and 13. It is in two volumes. And of course, it tells the story of Anne Boleyn's innocence through the eyes of a modern-day historical heroine who is drawn back in time and finds herself in the body of Anne Boleyn herself and witnesses firsthand the love, passion and betrayal that leads her eventually to her fate upon the scaffold. Oh my goodness, this is a book that's close to my heart, and I spent so much time delving into the detail of what life was like at the Tudor court. Found myself deep in Anne's body, experiencing all the crazy tumult of emotions which she must have experienced in her love affair with Henry. It was, in fact, my coming out. This was when I first began to share my passion for the Tudors online. And of course, one thing has led to another. Other books would follow, and eventually the Tudor Travel Guide, which came from my love of Tudor buildings and Tudor places, which was very much nurtured through the research process of writing Le Temps Viendra. And this month, in fact, on the 15th of August, I am delighted, if not a little surprised, to say that it is the 10th anniversary of the first publication of the first volume of LTV. And of course, I couldn't let that pass without a little celebration. I'll be doing one or two things over on social media to celebrate the day, including a publication of a chapter or part of a chapter from LTV Volume 2. And I'm also going to do a live over on my YouTube channel sometime in the middle of August. So make sure that you are subscribed to my blog via the homepage at www.thetudortravelguide.com, and I'll be sending any significant notices of things that are coming up out to my email list. And one final thing. How could I not, on this very special month, donate a copy of both Le Temps Viendra Volume 1 and 2 as part of my giveaway for my Patreon programme? So, if you are sponsoring the Patreon programme at over $5 or more a month, then you will be eligible to be entered into the draw for this month's patron gift, which, of course, I will announce at the end of this month. Okay, well, it is now time to get on with our adventure du jour. And I was really excited to head down to Sussex and to visit the Weald and Downland Museum. It's a museum that I've heard so much about and was so keen to visit because I very often get emails from people or messages on social media saying, I love learning about the aristocrats and the palaces, but what about the ordinary Tudor people? Tell me more about the ordinary Tudor people and the places in which they lived. Well, there's no finer place to do that than the Weald and Downland Museum. Now, I will let our guide today, John Roberts, tell you all about the museum and its purpose and what you can hope to find there. In this particular podcast, you're going to be finding out all about a typical medieval hall house. That's H-A-L-L. I didn't want any ambiguity in there. From our guide. Now, a hall house was first built during the medieval period, but it was a typical kind of house that persisted into the 16th century, so is very much relevant to our period. And you'll be hearing about the house, its construction, about the spaces and how it was used, and the kind, the level and the status of the person who would have owned such a house. So strap yourself in, my friends, because we're about to go time travelling, and we're travelling right into the heart of ordinary Tudor England. So hello everyone, welcome to the Weald and Downland Museum. This is my first time here, so as you can imagine, I'm incredibly excited to be here because it's a place I have wanted to come to for such a long time, not least because it's just full of gorgeous historic buildings, medieval Tudor buildings and others. But of course, our attention, as ever, will be on some of the Tudor buildings that are here at the museum. Now, the Weald and Downland Museum is in a part of England, southern England, called Downland. It's close to the South Downs, and it's a beautiful area of the countryside, full of glorious rolling hills and dotted with woodland and copses and other kind of open bracken land. It's a really beautiful place. So I am now joined by our very special guest for today. Hello, John. Welcome to the Tudor History and Travel Show.
Hi, Sarah.
So thank you for joining us today and being our guide in this fantastic museum. I just say for those people listening in, you may hear some sound of wind in the background because I think we've picked a morning where there's a howling gale going on, but thankfully the sun is out. So, John, before we get into talking about these amazing places, maybe you could just introduce yourself and tell us what you do here.
Yes, my name's John Roberts and my job title is Rural Life Interpreter. So I have to explain to the visitors the working life of the countryside over the past, well, for about 1,000 years.
Oh,
from
wow.
Late Saxon through to the early 20th century.
Oh gosh, so you really do have to cover a huge period of history. But we're going to get you to focus in on quite a narrow part of that history, of course, Tudor history today. So you've been here, you were telling me before we hit the record button, you've been here for what, 35 years?
That's right, yes.
Wow, so what you don't know about this place, I guess, is not worth knowing.
Oh, you're still learning all the time. And history moves on as interpretations change and more evidence comes to light.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, before we start exploring some of the buildings, maybe you could just tell us about the museum, what it is, how you describe it, how it came into being, and what it's here for.
Well, it first opened in 1970, but had been founded 5 years before that. And it was founded as a last refuge for vernacular, ordinary people's buildings, not just houses, but workshops and farm buildings. Because in the wake of post-war redevelopment, with lots of bits of the country having been knocked down and an ageing building stock, the buildings of the ordinary people were being swept away with new town development and the like, and a chap called Roy Armstrong, with a group of volunteers that he'd been working with Workers Educational Association and the Weald and Building Study Group, realised that there was actually a prospect that all of these buildings could be lost. And he wanted to save a few examples. So all the buildings that we take here, they have to have no future on their original site,
right?
Because Roy believed that they lost 99% of their story once you moved them. And they have to be something we don't have to have an example of already. And also they have to be from the Weald and Downland area.
Okay, so all local to here. And the museum itself, what area does it cover and how many buildings do you have on site roughly?
It covers about 50 acres and we've got above 50 structures now.
Okay.
But they range from quite small.
Ah, yes, we've passed a few of those little, what would you call some of the smaller places?
Well, we've got workshops and cattle sheds and living vans.
And up to the grander buildings, which would have been what, merchants' houses? Or how would you describe those?
Well, Bayleaf House, which we're going to talk about, is probably about as high up the social scale as we go.
Okay, right.
So the top of the peasantry.
Ah, the top of the peasantry. And I know there are many of you out there who email me regularly and ask me about, you know, what was ordinary Tudor life like? So I was really keen to come down here, and that's what we're going to be exploring today. So I think maybe we should take a look at our first building.
Okay, yeah.
So John, you've brought me up from the sort of the ticket area through part of the museum, and we've arrived at what I would describe as a timber-framed kind of wattle and daub house called Bayleaf Farm. Now, is that a reasonable description for this building?
It is, yes. This is a medieval timber-framed hall house, which may seem odd as you want to talk about the Tudors, but this is how it looks at the beginning of the 1500s.
Right, so just as we're... And I think you were also saying that this is the kind of house that would have continued through the Tudor period, so it would be typical of its type through that era, through the 16th century as well?
Yes, how ordinary people design their houses changes through the 1500s and into the early 1600s. And these changes are pushed by economic changes, social changes, not just technology, which is how a modern person always wants to see all change.
Okay, well, maybe you could describe a little bit about that. First of all, just describe for us what we can actually see, and then maybe you could talk a little bit about those changes and how houses developed from the sort of the 15th through to the end of the 16th century.
Right, well, what we have in front of us is about the best lifestyle you could probably hope for as anyone below gentry level. This is a yeoman farmer's house. But it is a classic late medieval building. It has an open hall in the centre, open because there is no first floor.
Yep.
And your heating system is a fire not quite in the middle of the floor. So you need that space to let your smoke disperse. Then at either end, you do have an upper floor.
Yes, I can see that.
And this particular building, which is a type called a wealden, it is jetted, it projects over the front.
And is there a reason for that? Is that just to make the upper floor space bigger, or was there another reason why that was built in that fashion?
Well, we have to post-rationalise a bit here, which is always a dangerous thing to do. We think jettying did develop in towns where you had a restricted building site and you could gain more floor area by extending over the street. But the tenant living in this building had a very large farm. If he wanted more floor area, he could have just made the whole house bigger. So we think it's status.
Oh, so just like a really nice architectural feature that says something about, look,
yes,
I can have these wonderful kind of wooden beams and so on projecting from the house.
Yes, and we think that's, our view of this is reinforced by the fact that it's jetted at the front and it's jetted at one end, but not the other.
Oh. So.
And the end that it's jetted was the end that pointed towards the track that went by it.
The street, where,
yes,
it would be seen by the passers-by. Yeah, okay, that's really interesting. Now, do you know who lived here? Do we have any records of its history, this particular building?
Well, finding records for vernacular buildings of the ordinary people, is haphazard, really. You have to strike lucky. And we are quite lucky with this house because it had a name. Now, we call it Bayleaf House. It's a corruption of its original name because we think it was built either by or for a chap called Henry Bailey, somewhere between about 1405 and 1430.
Right.
So it was Bailey's house.
I see, yeah.
And then over time, it's been corrupted to Bayleaf. And you find it spelled all sorts of different ways in documents.
And so he was a farmer, essentially.
We know very little about him, because from what we can tell, he died soon after the house was built. And we only start to know, we know who lived in here throughout this period, but we only start to know a lot about the families from about the 1560s onwards.
I see. And what about the later family? What do we know of them? I'm just so curious because, you know, it's the people who live here that bring these buildings to life, isn't it? There's the stories that I think you talked about before.
Well, it was lived in by a chap called Thomas Wells. And in documents, he's described in three different ways in different documents. He's described as a yeoman, a carpenter, and a farmer.
Is that unusual? Because they seem like quite different occupations to me.
Well, yeoman sort of shows his place in society. It's not a class because our class system doesn't really develop until the 1700s as we understand it.
Right.
But they're a particular level of the tenant farmers right at the top.
Okay, and actually, look, while we're here, there will be a lot of people listening to this who don't know what kind of levels of Tudor society, you know, can you describe them right down from the peasants upwards? Can you give us a feel for particularly the so-called ordinary folk, not necessarily the aristocratic classes?
Well, the late Tudors are actually starting to write down descriptions of how society is divided up. So at the very top, you have the aristocracy, who are the super rich of their day, mostly. Then below them is the gentry. And the key elements of, you know, both these sections of society is they own land. They own the freehold to land. Below that, you are generally renting your land. You're a tenant.
Right.
And the key thing about being gentry is you make your money from rents, not from the sweat of your brow.
Yes. I get
but,
it.
But within every section of this society, there are different levels of this. So at the very bottom are, you know, the criminals, the insane. Then you've got what later sort of get called the deserving poor, who are sort of destitute for no fault of their own. Then the labourers. Then husbandmen, which we might term as smallholders or subsistence farmers, who probably also supplement their income by labouring for people like the tenants of Bayleaf.
I see. So this guy would be renting his land. Did he then sublet it then to the husbandmen, for example? How did they rent their land?
No, he didn't. Often, husbandmen are renting directly from the landowner. Subletting does occur a lot, and it gets more and more common, and it makes a nightmare of trying to pick out who's actually living in somewhere. But strictly speaking, it wasn't legal.
Okay, right.
Most landlords.
Now, I'm aware that about 5-10 minutes ago, I asked you a question about how houses evolved from the 15th to the 16th century, and you started beautifully to describe what we see in front of us now. But could you then just forward wind that story and talk about how kind of ordinary houses developed and why they did so?
I can try.
Okay, go
for it.
It's still
a contentious
issue.
Oh,
okay.
But what happens, probably for most ordinary people from about the middle of the 1500s onwards, is they start to change their house design. And the biggest innovation, we'll call it, is putting in a chimney. And once you install a chimney, you can have a first floor all the way across because you don't need that open space to let the fire, smoke from the fire disperse.
It's so obvious when you say it, John.
And you lose the big central room, the hall. But it enables you to have more rooms. So rooms tend to go from being multifunctional to unifunctional in essence anyway. I think the practicality was a bit different, but...
But that was the movement towards...
That was the movement. And it's probably pushed a bit by change in society above this level. So if you're a medieval king, it's very, very important that you're visible. So, you know, sitting in your great hall behind the table going, I'm the king, going on your tours around the country going, I'm the king.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
As you go through the Tudor period, you then start to show your importance by being inaccessible. So you get these big palaces where you famously get Elizabeth I receiving her most favoured courtiers in her bedchamber. And this is all about this sort of progression through a series of rooms to show how powerful you are, and how far you get shows how important you are.
Yeah, right.
Now, I'm not saying this goes all the way down society, but there is more of a push maybe for privacy, and then separating out the functions of your rooms helps this.
Yeah, so there is, normal people are picking up on trends set by the well-to-do, which is of course what happens today.
Exactly, yes. Humans don't change in essence.
No, they don't.
And you were also getting new, in big inverted commas, building material, brick.
Right.
Starts to be introduced.
So what was the impact? So tell me about, actually, that's a good point, John. So we talked about this being timber framed, with, and the timber frame is infilled with this wattle and daub. So what is wattle and daub? Let's get that definition down.
Right. Well, wattle is a lattice work of sticks, essentially. It's there are various forms of it. Sometimes it's cleft sticks nailed to upright, sometimes it's woven, can be made out of a range of materials. This one here, it's woven hazel. Then that's covered with early form of plaster, really, daub. Now, there's not a recipe for daub.
Okay.
It's basically mud and chopped up straw or chopped up vegetation to bind it all together. Sometimes it has animal dung in it. Sometimes it has other additives like lime. But when we've analysed it from our buildings, it's very obvious it comes from the local area. So you probably just dug it out from the building site.
So, I mean, it amazes me, wattle and daub, that it's got such durability. Did it have to be replaced regularly, or does it really, you know, is it very resilient and resistant to the effects of the weather?
If it's kept water resistant by lime washing it.
Ah, which is what we have
here. Which we have on the outside, that's why it's bright white.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the colour. This is a, you know, an accurate mix. People tend to think that everything will be, you know, brownie colour, particularly film companies. Yes, but that's how it stays, because it's very, very good at suppressing the growth of stuff on it.
Ah, yeah, great.
Sometimes it was coloured. There's evidence of some pink and yellow.
Well, you raise a good point, because as I was driving here, I was talking to my sound man, Chris, and I was saying, because we go to Suffolk a lot, and of course, if people go to Suffolk, they'll be very aware of the Suffolk pink houses. It's kind of a hallmark of the county. And I was saying, is there a particular architectural feature of kind of Sussex, of this area? So you're the best man to ask.
Not in that same way. There's more and more evidence coming to light that timbers were quite often painted, but never black. That's, yeah. Well, in this area, that's a, you know, late Victorian Edwardian thing, uh-huh. of the stockbroker Tudor look.
Okay.
yes. But you know, red and yellow ochre. And we do have one building which we have painted the timbers red, because we have conclusive evidence, because there was paint in areas you couldn't get to once you put the house up.
Right, okay.
So yeah. It was painted from the first.
Yeah, right, okay, great. So before we go inside and maybe explore the interior of the building, John, are there any other misconceptions about the construction or the style of these buildings that you need to point out to us from the outside?
Well, we often get asked, wasn't it originally thatched? Mm. And the answer is almost certainly no. Tiles become, particularly in the eastern counties, very common from about 1200 onwards. And we have written evidence of things like pigsties being tiled in the 1200s.
Wow, I had no idea it was so early. Crikey, that's amazing. But brick, of course, came in the late 15th century, early 16th century, for the aristocracy at least.
Yes, I mean, it's starting to come in mid 15th century. We never really completely stopped making bricks. We just stopped using them for building structures out of, after the Romans went home.
So why was that, do you think? Any evidence for...
Well, the Germanic peoples coming in were great woodworkers.
Okay.
So yeah. Why would you?
Okay.
yes.
Interesting.
There's more evidence coming to light of them doing tile making, but it tends to be for things like hearths and ovens and the like.
And we may be straying a little bit off topic here, but since we are talking about brick and I'm interested in it, what was the impetus for brick coming back in, resurfacing as a popular building material?
Again, we probably don't really know, but possibly it's fueled by Renaissance ideas, where they're starting to look back to the classical age and the regularity of Greek architecture, which you can't achieve with timber.
I see.
Whereas brick is a completely regular material, and when you build something like Hurstmonceux Castle or in the extreme case, Hampton Court Palace, you can make everything regular and symmetrical.
I see. That makes a lot of sense. I think that's a very good answer.
And this may actually be confirmed by what we see happening in ordinary people's buildings when they build out of brick, in that they're not generally buying the best quality, they're buying seconds, which are irregular. So there's this practice called pencilling and raddling, or raddling and pencilling.
Oh, explain.
You fill up the mortar joints so they're flush with the front of the brickwork, with these rather irregular bricks, paint the whole thing red, and then paint in lines.
Ah, yes.
To give you regular brickwork.
Yeah, so you're saying really that it was very fashionable, and
yes,
that would make sense as to
yes,
why it was adopted again by those at the highest part of society, and then everybody
yes,
else tried to replicate that.
It's driven by fashion, not technology.
Yeah, right, okay. Well, I think that's a great introduction to the outside of this house, so I think we need to go inside and explore inside, so why don't we go? To go inside Bailey Farm, but I just want to let you know, listeners, that the museum is open to the public. There are school parties around, so you may well hear the sounds of people enjoying themselves in the background. Whew, well, we've come inside out of the howling gale, and you've brought me into the centre of the house, which, as you explained from the outside, is the hall for the house. So can you tell me a little bit more about what I can see, the features that you might want to look out for if you're in visiting any kind of building like this?
Well, we've stepped into the hall, set out as it would be for having your main meal of the day. So the table is set here. But the hall itself is quite interesting because it probably reflects what goes on higher up in society. It's a hierarchical space.
Uh-huh.
So we come in through the back door.
Oh, right.
So
yes,
we must have been working on the farm today. But we have a cross passage. We have front and back doors opposite one another.
Okay, so that's the service end of the hall, the low end of the hall, and the kitchens. What else do we need to take notice of?
What else do we need? Well, this is what we call a two-bay hall. It's got two structural bays, and you can spot them by posts which go all the way from the ground to
yes,
the wall plate at the eaves. This lower bay has no windows in it.
That's right, it doesn't, yes.
Whereas the upper bay does. The fire is in the upper bay.
Yes, so we've got a central
yes,
fireplace in the middle of the hall here,
yes,
just in front of the table, in the kind of the up towards the
yes,
high end of the hall.
So you're in status no man's land in this bit. Well, the tenant farm or whatever decides where you belong.
Ah, okay.
Yes.
So it's a kind of place to be received, maybe, and,
yes,
and you
yes,
would get direction about what
yes,
where you would go from here.
Yes, and our former director and research director, Richard Harris, had a brilliant analogy of that this is pure theatre, or it is when it's being used formally.
Yes, right.
So,
yes, explain. If I came in, what would happen?
Right. Well, it's all in the layout. So you've got these two opposed windows spotlighting the high table.
So they're on either, just for those people listening in,
yes,
they're on either side, either wall, with the table
yes,
in the centre at the high end.
Yeah. You have got the fire closer to the high table than to the low end. There are your footlights.
All right, yes.
You've got a hanging cloth behind the table to draw attention to you. It's your stage cloth.
Yeah, so that would be a tapestry or the most
yeah,
expensive thing that they could afford.
Yes,
I guess,
this is
from
a painted wall hanging in this particular place, copied on a design from a house in Wales. But they were colourful and busy.
Yeah.
And there would probably be more than one in here.
Right.
So these places weren't as dingy as we probably,
mm-hmm,
or even here, tend to suggest.
Mm-hmm.
Because Yes, painted cloths in 1500s were relatively cheap. In the 2000s, they're not.
And you know, the other thing I noticed, John, is there's no glass in the windows.
No glass, no. Doesn't tend to make it down to this level until about 1580.
Right, so quite late on.
Yes, it's improvements in manufacturing techniques which enabled bigger sheets of it to be made, and therefore the price dropped.
And then people can afford it, because up until that point, glass was prohibitively expensive, wasn't it? And
good quality glass was, yes.
Yeah.
This is perhaps driven a little bit by Huguenot glassmakers fleeing the wars of religion in France.
So on a day like today, which is pretty breezy, during the day, would they, even if it was windy, would they have had the shutters open like this? Or, you know, would they be more concerned with preserving heat rather than having light in here?
That depends, really. At this time of year, on a day like this, main meal is probably going to be middle of the day.
Mm-hmm.
That remains so right up into the 1800s, early 20th century. But you would want light. What we're doing is living with the door open because we're a visitor attraction.
Yes.
And possibly you wouldn't have had all the shutters open, but when you open it up of a morning, you decide which way's the wind blowing. And don't open the shutters on that side.
Very practical, folk. To the low end of the hall, John. What's going on down here?
Yes, well, we have what's termed today the screens passage, a passageway that leads directly from the front door through to the back door.
Right, okay, yes.
And
I've seen this replicated in high status houses,
yes,
and
exactly.
Castles. It's exactly the same, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes, and often you will have a full screen in a high status house, whereas we've just got stub screens at either end, which to reduce the draft in the hall.
Yeah, right, okay.
And coming in through the front door on our right, we have the two, what are now termed service rooms. Any book on vernacular architecture will tell you they're the buttery and the pantry.
Uh-huh.
So the buttery is for storing butts, barrels, so wet good storage.
And I can see we've got barrels in here.
We have got a few, yes. The pantry is for dry good storage after the French for bread, pan.
Okay.
And in a high status house, you had a pantler and a butler.
Perfect.
To look after them.
And do you know, I'm so glad you talked about the buttery being for butts, because I for a long time thought it was something to do with butter.
Yes.
And I guess that's a very common misconception.
It is indeed, yes.
Now, what we don't have here is that I've definitely seen many times in high status houses is a central passage that would have gone off into the kitchen. So where was the kitchen in a whole house like
this? Well, we think from the archaeology that was done on the site that the kitchen was just outside the back door.
Okay, right. So easy to access, get to bring into the hall. And I guess it was just extra space. It didn't take up space because it's... You need quite a bit of room for a kitchen, right, of the period?
Yes, I mean, you're catering for quite a large household.
Yeah.
And you're doing so much of your cooking from scratch. So you are doing things like brewing, baking, butchery.
Yeah, right.
You don't really want that going on in your living room.
No, not really. Right, really adjacent to where you're trying to eat. No, exactly. Now, since you mentioned quite a large household, how many people would have been involved in a house like this, including the family and those people who helped look after the house?
Well, we've nominally set it at between about 8 and 10, which will be parents and children, and probably two youngish household servants.
Right.
Or one or two.
Yeah.
Who were kind of learning their trade. They're often teenage girls.
Okay.
Who've moved here from a slightly lower status household.
Yeah.
And they are regarded as part of your family.
Oh, I see, right.
In fact, they're probably regarded as slightly more valuable than young children.
Because they did work.
Because they're useful.
They did work.
Yes.
So they lived in the house. They didn't just come to work
like we would
do today.
They lived in the house.
Okay, right. And would they live here until they married, for example, and then maybe move on? You know, what was kind of the life of a young servant girl like you were just referring to?
Yes, well, you kind of have to look at both the men and the women. So you're probably starting your working life around about the age of 13, possibly a bit earlier.
Yeah, right.
And what a boy is trying to do, or a young man, is raise enough money so he can start renting land. And at that point, he'll look to marry. So the age at first marriage is probably older than we think, or tends to be the popular view. So it's around about 27 in the mid-1500s, and about 24, 25 for a woman. So yes, she would be learning housekeeping skills and also saving some money as well. To be able to pay an entry fine to, basically a deposit to start renting land.
Yeah. So if you were a young man and you couldn't get the money together, what would happen to you then? How would your life tend to pan out?
Well, you'd probably be able to get enough together to at least rent a cottage.
Right.
A cottage is sort of defined as a dwelling that doesn't have enough land to support it or to support its inhabitants.
Right.
And then you will be, you probably have a small bit of land that you'd be a small holder.
Yeah.
But you'd supplement that by labouring on other people's land.
I see.
Or practising trades that didn't require huge capital set up.
Yeah.
Shoemaking is a very common one.
Right, okay. Yeah. So I'm thinking of when the aristocracy climbed the social ladder, they often, or let's say, you know, I'm thinking the likes of Wolsey or Cromwell, for example, they were just talented men and they were noticed. And then, you know, one thing led to another. They went into service of a powerful patron and then they got land and so on and so forth. How would somebody lower down the social scale get on in life and maybe come from a husbandman to a yeoman farmer? How would that typically happen if it did at all?
Well, from that level of husbandman to yeoman farmer, we'd probably have to go all the way back to the Great Plague.
Right.
So we had probably, in the wake of the plague itself, subsequent epidemics, famines, about two-thirds of the population wiped out before 1400.
Yeah.
This meant there was a large amount of land
right.
that was available. So the gentry are keen to have tenants because they don't want to work their own land. They want to get their money from rents.
Mm.
Similarly, labour's in short supply. So you can start demanding more for your skilled or semi-skilled labour.
Mm.
So you can start putting together capital.
Mm.
So when Chaucer is writing, he doesn't include in the late 1300s a yeoman amongst his characters. A yeoman at that stage just meant a young man who was a servant in a big household.
Right.
By the end of the 1400s, the yeoman is starting to mean something very, very particular at the top end of the peasantry. And there are both modern and contemporary definitions of what a yeoman is.
Okay. So what is a yeoman then, exactly, John?
Yes. Well, a modern historian's definition is he's a tenant farmer, so he doesn't own land, but he's farming for profit, not subsistence. So he's doing what his land does best.
Right.
He's generally employing non-family wage labour to help him do that. He's often holding parish offices, a constable, later in the Tudor period, overseer of the poor, a church warden. These are unpaid posts, but they confer a certain status. And they are seen as entrepreneurial, so often they'll have a secondary economic activity. So in the eastern part of the High Weald, it's often cloth making, raising sheep and stuff like that.
Right.
In this area, you may be involved in the iron industry. We spoke about glass, the glass industry.
Mm-hmm.
You might be the local miller. They want to make money because money gives you choice.
Uh-huh.
But it doesn't give you status. So something that comes up from contemporary sources is they will try to get one of their sons an education. Because if he's educated, he can either go into the church or the law.
Mm-hmm.
And then his son will be a gentleman.
Mm-hmm. Back to the Wolseys and the Cromwells of this world.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Because,
yes,
of course, Wolsey was famously a butcher's son and Cromwell's was a blacksmith.
Yeah.
So you can see that transition, what the potential, obviously it only happened to a tiny, tiny, tiny number of people, but the potential was there.
But the static population through, you know, since the 1400s right to the end of the 1500s meant that these opportunities were there.
They were there. Okay, so let's go and investigate. I can see there's a doorway leading from the top end of the hall into another room. Perhaps we could go and investigate that.
Yeah.
Yeah, certainly.
Okay, so we've come into a smaller room. It's got a staircase leading up to the first floor. We have a bed in here. So typically, what was this room all about?
Well, we've sort of gone past the high table, so we're definitely into the family's end of the house. And this is where these concepts of privacy are starting to come in. By the late 1500s, this room is often being referred to as the parlour. And it is still multifunctional. So maybe your older children, if they're still living at home, or household servants were sleeping in here.
Okay.
We have evidence it's often a workroom. From the point of view, there'll often be things like spinning wheels listed in it, hence putting the wheel, great
indeed
wheel
we do.
In here.
Yes, indeed we do.
Although wool was not that important in this part of the world, most people would do a bit of home spinning, either for, you know, darning or for selling on.
So the family retired to this space. Any guests maybe brought
you
in
may
here
have entertained
well?
In here as well. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to know. The only thing we can kind of base it on are probate inventories, lists of goods at death, as to what's in various rooms.
Right.
And they always tend to suggest that the upstairs room at the high end is the most important bedroom. If you find the best bed in the room we're standing in, the parlour, it may suggest that the tenant's become infirm or is elderly.
Ah,
and they don't want to make
sense.
The stairs anymore.
Yes. Because there's a pretty steep stairs that I can look at here. We've got a lovely wooden staircase. It's like a ladder staircase almost, taking you up to the first floor.
Yes, well, there's no building regs on staircases, so you know, why take up more space than you need to? Yes.
Then.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's go up the staircase and we'll explore what's up this. Oh, here we go. It's steep. It's steep, folks. Thank you. All right. So, yes. I can already see kind of the furniture you've decorated this room is kind of more high. It feels more high status to me.
Yes. So we've put the best bed in here. The what we know as a four-poster bed, but they generally refer to as a tester bed, from the top, the head of the bed. And it's basically like having a built-in bed. If you look up, there is no ceiling.
That's right, we've just got the beams.
You've just got the tiles above you,
yeah.
And you can see loads of spiders' webs and the like, so all this will be dropping on you as you're sleeping. Also, of course, it keeps you warm. You've got the curtains all around it, but it is a status symbol.
Yeah. And we've got this truckle. Is that what's called
a truckle?
Yeah,
yep.
A truckle.
Yep, truckle means little wheel, and it has little wheels. Yes, and they're not a modern invention. They've been around for ages. So
who slept on there?
Could be children. Could be one of the household servants.
Right. Okay.
Famously, a bit later, Samuel Pepys got into dreadful trouble for having his maidservant Deb Willett sleeping in the truckle bed in him and his wife's bedroom.
sounds saucy to me, John.
It was, yes. Yes.
Okay, so this was purely used for sleeping, or were there other functions? You said this was the... was this like a solar? I'm trying to think.
Well, solar's an anachronistic term by this time. Upstairs rooms are generally known by what they're above. So they probably would have referred to this the parlour chamber, or the chamber over the parlour, or some similar, like the one at the other end would be the chamber over the buttery.
Yeah, right, got you.
It might, by the sort of 1560s, be used for private entertaining. Mm. It might possibly be used for business accounting. Now, interestingly, Thomas Wells, who was the yeoman farmer living here from the 1560s, we know he couldn't write. That doesn't necessarily mean he couldn't read.
Right, okay.
Yes.
Okay, interesting.
They're two separate skills.
So again, we have multifunctional use, don't we,
yes.
Really? And I can see a garderobe in the corner there. So.
Yeah, by this stage, usually referred to as a privy or a jakes.
Okay.
So
when did garderobe, was that a medieval term then, and then the Tudors tended to call it privy
more
and jakes?
More medieval and high status.
I see.
This is interesting because they're not common on rural buildings, you know. Why would you bother?
Quite, you just go outside,
but again,
I guess.
Again, I think it is probably, you know, showing a bit of status. We had the jointing for it on the outside timbers, that's why we put it back there.
Yeah.
It does save you having to go down those stairs on a cold winter's night.
Yes, quite. I can definitely see the utility of it, for sure. Good, is there anything else we need to know about this room?
Well, we've got a little bit of decoration up here. An even cheaper version of what we had downstairs. Mm-hmm. So this is actually a block printed cloth,
right. Hanging on the wall,
opposite the bed, just to brighten the place up. And it's based on a scrap that still survives in the Victoria and Albert Museum.
Right. And would there have been any other sort of, you know, we have knickknacks and paintings on the wall and stuff like that. Would there any other, how did they decorate the interiors?
Well, the thing that we do have evidence for and we haven't done here is the furniture was often painted. They loved bright colours.
Yeah.
And interiors would be a lot busier from the point of view of their decoration than we probably give them credit for.
Right. And so maybe these beams, may they have been painted as well? You were talking about painted beams.
Possibly. We have an interior from a bit later, from probably early 1600s, which has a fireplace.
Mm.
And yes, a free-form floral decoration is on all the walls, across all the timbers and across the ceiling.
So that's really their wall, almost like their wallpaper.
Yeah.
And yeah. Okay, that makes sense.
But it's
sense.
Not worth painting your walls until you've got a chimney.
Because of the smoke?
Because of the smoke blackening.
I mean, we didn't say downstairs, but in the Great Hall, one of the things that strikes you when you first walk in is the walls and the ceiling are absolutely black.
Yes. So these are... often it's an earth pigment in an animal skin glue, essentially, that you paint with. They're sort of spongible,
right.
But again, because they're cheap, you can replace them easily.
Yeah, right, okay. I mean, that's fascinating. I really didn't think about the importance of having a chimney before you painted your walls, but standing in this, I can see, as I say, because folks, everywhere you go in this room, even if you're away from the main fireplace, we're in the bedroom, and you can still see the walls are blackened, so the smoke must have got everywhere.
Yes, and the evidence that we have from surviving interior wattle and door panels, we would expect today that there'd be the lime wash layer, the black tar layer, another lime wash layer, another black tar layer, but you don't find that. There's just one lime wash layer and then there's tar.
Right.
It's very, very difficult to lime wash over it.
Yeah.
And you'd probably be needing to do it about once every 3 months.
Right.
Going by my experience of how quickly it
blackens. Yeah, incredible, isn't it? And, you know, obviously candlelight was the only other way of having light, or, I mean, candles were expensive, weren't they?
The
grade of candle, maybe I'm talking beeswax candles versus...
Well, beeswax candles were prohibitively expensive, and even a yeoman farmer wouldn't have had beeswax.
Mm.
Tallow candles were, if you were sort of a farm worker at this period, you know, a day's wages would probably get you about, 18 tallow candles.
Right, okay.
With about maybe a 1.5 hour burning time each.
Okay, right.
But I mean, the thing, at an ordinary social level, it's much probably more useful to think of candles as a torch rather than a room lighter.
Uh-huh,
or
right.
A navigation point.
So it just got you from place to place,
yes.
If it was dark, really.
Yeah,
I see. But I am now just thinking, because again, in this chamber, we have this kind of slats for windows. There's no glass here. There's no shutters here either. Now, whether there would have been originally.
Well, there are.
These are the shutters. Oh, right. Do you know what? I wondered what they were. So what John's just done is they kind of slide down, and they almost look like panels against the lower part of the wall beneath the windows, but they are shutters. Because I was just thinking how unbelievably cold it would be in the middle of winter, even with the shutters up.
Yes. Yeah.
Gosh, because there's no fireplace in here. Of course. The only fire in the whole house is down in the middle of the hall.
Yes. But I think this is a conception that of how you keep warm that has changed probably in the last 50 years with the introduction of central heating.
Yeah. I was just thinking.
Prior to that, my parents' generation, if you wanted to be warmer indoors, you put another layer on. Yeah. You didn't turn the fire up.
Well, I tell you what, with the rises in in fuel prices that's going, I think we're all going to be doing that again. Yeah, I guess you get used to it, don't you? And I was just thinking, gosh, thank goodness for my central heating. But I suspect if this is what you're used to, you do just, you know, you kind of get used to it in a way.
Yeah, well, you certainly live with it and you know no different from it. But I dare say that, you know, cold winter's evening, you did tend to make a bit of a dash from the fire into the bed.
You probably did.
Yes.
Great. Well, let's go back downstairs. Thanks for that, John. That was really interesting. Gosh, they are steep stairs, aren't they? So John, you brought me back downstairs. We're going across the Great Hall. We're back down to the low ends of the hall, and there's another staircase.
Another staircase, yes.
So you're taking me up where this time?
Well, up to the chamber above the buttery or the chamber above the milk house, depending on how they wanted to refer to it.
Absolutely. And another steep wooden staircase.
Yes. And another multi-use room. So maybe accommodation for extra young farm workers.
Mm-hmm.
But what is clear about this room when we look through documents is it clarifies that your farmhouse was very much one of your farm buildings, because what you find up here are processed items, shall we say?
Uh-huh.
Sides of bacon, cheeses, seed corn, sacks of grain, because these are your valuables.
Right, yes.
You keep them somewhere that's going to be relatively vermin-free,
mm-hmm,
and secure.
Mm-hmm.
You break into a 16th century house, you're not after the flat screen telly, you're after the sacks of grain.
Yes.
Because that's what's readily saleable.
Right. So it is quite a spacious room. It's more spacious than the high status chamber at the other end of the house because of that, because it was used as storage.
This is what you almost always find is that, you know, what is the low end, the upstairs chamber, is bigger, because you'll be likely to have sacks and things hanging from the rafters.
Right,
and,
okay.
Yes.
And you squeeze a couple of beds maybe in there for the lowest, for the servants or who were helping out
in the house.
That's really wonderful.
And that really sort of completes the view. And we just sort of suggest that having sacks of grain up here is not that practical because we're not living here and therefore we'd have mice everywhere. But we have put a grain ark.
What's a grain ark?
It's a large chest that's designed for storing threshed out grain.
Ah, I see. So we've got a wooden chest here.
Yeah.
Kind of an ark shaped.
Yes.
Is that
as in Ark of the Covenant?
Yes, exactly. Yes. That's exactly what it looks like.
Like a lot of their furniture, it comes to pieces. So you can just knock the pegs out,
uh-huh,
and it flat packs.
Right. How convenient.
And also this one.
So John's lifting the lid.
Lifts off.
I can lift that end. Oh my goodness. Gosh, oak is heavy, isn't it?
Turn it over.
Ooh, yes.
And that's your dough kneading trough.
Oh, so we've just turned it. We've taken the lid off, turned it over.
Mm.
And instead of being a lid, we've now got this concave trough. And that's where you knead the bread.
Yes.
So it's a multi-purpose piece of furniture. Wow.
Yes.
That's amazing, isn't it? Right, let's get this over. I don't want to drop it. Okay, slotting it back in to place. There we go. That's amazing. I don't think I've seen one of those before, actually, so that's really interesting.
And this is actually one that our late carpenter copied from a survivor in Leeds Castle.
Ah, okay, I see.
Also in Kent.
Very good, very good. So we've done our tour of the house. Thank you so much for telling us about the house and the people who lived here and the way the rooms were used. It was just fascinating. I just wanted to ask you about the museum in general for people who are interested in visiting. So what would you say about folk coming here? What are your particular favourites, your highlights, things you would urge them really to look out for?
Well, I like the stories behind the buildings, which all our most of our buildings will have volunteers in them who are usually very well informed about the stories behind them. And I personally, you know, I'm usually sort of explaining things by doing them. I work in the woods a lot. And what I think this places like this are great for is bringing together the lifestyle, because today our lives are so segmented in life, work, balance, but also our skill sets tend to be very, very specific, whereas in the past they were very, very general. And you see this actually in documents of the period, that it depends when someone was required to give a deposition, what time of year it was, what they described themselves as. So they might be a brickmaker in the summer, they might be a woodsman in the winter.
So multi-talented.
You had to be competent at quite a lot of things.
Yeah.
Didn't have to be brilliant, but you had
competent.
To be competent.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
Everything fits together, the sort of the agriculture, the woodland work, affects your food, how you prepare and cook your food, what materials you're using for your clothing, how you build your buildings, how you build your carts. And it's this connectivity that fascinates me, and how hopefully somewhere like this can help put some of those stories together for people.
Do you have a lot of kind of living demonstrations? People may call them kind of reenactments or living history demonstrations of some of these skills and crafts in action here at the museum.
Well, as far as possible, we try to do the things that actually the museum needs done in a way that they would have been done at some period in our building's history.
I see, right.
So yeah. I base my woodland management techniques on 16th, 17th century evidence.
So I'm meeting a living Tudor.
and Andy, our horseman, is managing the fields on a late 18, early 1900s practice.
Right.
And he's doing that because of the type of horses and the type of equipment he's got.
I see. And so people, if they come here, may see some of these activities just going on a day-to-day basis.
Yes, so we have a late 1800s, early 1900s flour mill that runs daily,
right.
A 1920s bakery, which was at that time was just about to close down because actually it's reflecting baking that goes back to the, well, probably the 18th century. The blacksmith shop is often working. There's usually something going on in the woodlands.
Brilliant.
And there's smaller scale demonstrations in the buildings themselves. So my colleague, Fiona, who's a domestic interpreter, this morning was training some of the volunteers to use the great wheel that we saw downstairs.
Oh, I see, right.
Yes.
So you don't really know what you're going to bump into. It's just kind of going on all the time.
We try to make it active all the time.
Yeah.
And we try to make it so that it does reflect the things that would have been done day to day with a seasonal basis.
Yeah, great. And so a couple of just questions. Is it open all year, this museum?
It is generally open all year.
Yeah.
Yes.
As long as COVID and other things
exactly.
aren't
yes.
getting
yes.
in the way. And I guess people can find out information on opening times, etc., from your website.
Yes. And we hold a dozen what we call historic life weekends throughout the year, which focus on a particular aspect. And we often have a number of outside contributors to those. So our most recent was on bread.
Okay.
From field to on your plate.
And that will all be on the website, I guess.
That's
the
all
information
on, the website,
on all
yes.
of those kind of special
yes.
events will be there as well.
The next one's looking at soil.
Brilliant. Oh, wow. Amazing. Okay. Well, I just want to say a massive thank you from me and on behalf of our listeners. It's been great to get back to ordinary Tudor England and to be inside not a palace, not a manor house, not a castle, but just an ordinary but yet fascinating Tudor building. Thank you so much.
No problem.
Well, I found that fascinating and I hope you did too. The Wealden Downland Museum is a very special place to visit. I mean, if you love your period buildings, and they do have, as you heard from John, buildings from across a whole range of different centuries, it really is a wonderful place to visit. And I loved being inside that hall house. Oh, it was so atmospheric and I learned so much. So I'm sure many of you out there will feel the same. So that's a huge thank you to John and behind the scenes, Lucy and Caroline, who all in their various ways made this happen. I'm deeply appreciative. Thank you so much. Well, that's all for this month's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. Thank you so much for tuning in. Next month is always a very exciting month in the Tudor Travel Guide calendar because it is the launch of booking for my annual virtual summit. And this year, it is all about Anne Boleyn. In fact, 500 years of Anne Boleyn, it girl, icon, and kick-ass legend. Yes, my friends, it's coming your way as autumn approaches here in the Northern Hemisphere. More information on that will come in next month's podcast. Until then, my friends, wherever you are in the world, take care, and I'll see you on the road again soon. Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. If you've loved the show, please take a moment to subscribe, like, and rate this podcast so that we can spread the Tudor love. Until next time, my friends, all that remains for me to say is happy time travelling.